Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
I don't like to stand here, present some egghead scientific argument based on fact. Science is a liar sometimes.
The great and boss has spoken. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Who are you? Who are you? A very bad man.
I'm a very good man. Good man. They think deep thoughts and with no more brains than you have.
Just a very bad wizard.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm Tamler Summers from the University of Houston. Dave, do you know if Roger Goodell likes apples?
No, not at all. I barely know who Roger Goodell is, but only because of you.
But do you think he likes apples, maybe?
I would assume so. Most normal people are on somewhere between the neutral and like for... For apples.
So okay. Just to confirm, you say you think he does like apples.
Yeah, given absolutely no information about this base rates. Who says like I hate apples?
So how does he like them apples? Bill Belichick, third string quarterback, 27-0 over the Houston Texans Thursday night. One of the great nights.
Is this why you're in such a good mood?
Yeah, one of the reasons.
I'm David Pizarro from Cornell University. How about them apples? I love how somehow you think that this is what people tune in to Very Bad Wizards to hear.
They want to hear me gloating about the Patriots' success. I think if we did a survey of what people like most about the show, it's when I start talking about Boston sports and caring.
You could have the Washington Post do that survey.
Yeah, exactly. The statistical significance, the statistical power, I guess, was low.
Very good.
I know my shit. So we have four topics to get to. We're going to try to keep a fairly tight time frame on the topics, although I think it'll be hard for especially the last one. The first is one that you don't even know about, but just happened to my daughter yesterday, and it sort of raised an interesting ethical issue. So I want to get your opinion about that. The second is the unraveling of your profession of social psychology. There was a big controversy in the last week in social psychology, right?
There was. From now on, I'm just calling myself a psychologist. I don't like labels. Not a social psychologist.
Yeah, soon it'll be like the Freudians are like the most respected people.
Yeah. Almost.
Third, we're going to talk about a really interesting paper that could lead to further, more in-depth discussion. But I just sort of came across it by accident, and it seems like what a good psychology paper would be. Although I haven't done a rigorous data analysis of it.
I want to check your browser history to see if you've actually downloaded the paper.
It's on my browser right now, And then fourth, in response to a number of requests.
Massive demand.
We're going to break down the Patriots' win over the Texans. the dismantling. No. We're going to talk about Mr. Robot Season 2 and especially the finale, which has been, it's fair to say, a little polarizing. Or at least it doesn't inspire the same sort of unanimous, what's the word?
Accolades. Should we put that sort of afterwards?
I mean, we'll just say this is the last thing we're discussing, and then. Yeah. And in fact, here's the thing about even for those people who are critical of Mr. Robot, I think a big part of that is a function of having to wait a week between episodes. And my guess is that that season two is better binge watched than.
Yep, I'm gonna rewatch the whole thing.
Yeah,
in a binge as soon as
I am too, and I'm actually looking forward to that. Even though, you know, I have some issues maybe with season two, but we'll talk about that.
Right.
But yeah, so if you haven't seen Mr. Robot yet, this is you might be lucky. But you need to see it and then listen to us talk about it.
Right. We'll make it clear when we start talking about it.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk the first topic, which, again, you don't know about.
Can I just say for the record, it always makes me really nervous when I don't know what you're going to introduce. So,
well, this is fairly.
You're a wild card. You're like Charlie on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's just.
It could be a riddle about dicks and cucumbers. Right?
It could just yeah.
Actually, this is much more serious and much less dick-oriented than normal. So, or, yeah, maybe almost entirely not dick-oriented. So my daughter is at a rough start to seventh grade. She, in the first week, her two best friends at the school left the school for various reasons. But the one really good thing that was happening for her was she landed the lead role in a play that, and this is a, you know, it's a performing arts magnet school. So she was playing the part of Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, right. I was going to guess, you know, Boo Radley.
So I was working with her on her lines, helping her memorize her lines. And I sort of noticed that as we were going through it, that a lot of the really bad racist stuff, including whenever any character says the N-word, that was cut out of
right.
of the play. And I sort of, at the time, as I'm working with her, I'm sort of complaining about this. Like, this is a play about racism, and this is kind of a sanitized version of it. You know, and I had some problems with that, and she's like, "Yeah, but we're middle schoolers, you know," and you know, really,
not all children were raised like you raised me, Dad.
And yeah, I had some sort of artistic problems with it, but her main concern was learning her lines, performing the part well. This was a big deal for her, and it was, like I said, like in a year where nothing has gone well so far, like. Right. This is the one thing. So,
can I ask a quick clarification question?
Yeah.
Was it also sort of toned down? I mean, because imagine that you remove the racial tension, like it's still about a rape accusation. Was it
even
clear
that was taken out? So the rape,
so it was just sanitizing.
Yeah. So it was like that. Anytime they were talking about rape, it was they would change it to sort of harm or something.
Tickling.
So. Thursday, Lai comes home. She's very upset because the theater teacher said that the playwright has demanded that they don't, like, sanitize it like they're sanitizing it, and demands that they have to say the N-word, right? They have
right.
to use that language. The play, the I don't know, like the whole moral point of the play is diluted if the people seem much less racist than they are in the book and the play adaptation of it. So we won't allow them to do the play like that. And playwrights have, you know, they're not like screenwriters where people just tell them to shut the fuck up. They own their plays.
Right, the rights. Wait, so yeah. So who is the playwright?
I don't know, because I didn't even know it was
this
a play.
Like Harper Lee, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
It wasn't Harper Lee. Now, Friday, the theater teacher has a decision, and this is what I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's very sort of interesting ethical question. Obviously, my daughter wanted them to decide that they would do the play, and they would do it, and they would, you know, say the words that are in the play, and that's, you know, if people handle that maturely, and, you know, you're doing To Kill a Mockingbird, they'd already blocked out the play, everyone had memorized their lines, everything is ready to go, it's actually part of a larger competition within Harris County, and Friday, so this is just yesterday, she finds out that the teacher is not going to do it. She's not even going to ask the principal. She's just going to abandon the play.
Wow.
And so, of course,
wow.
My daughter's been completely devastated. She thinks like seventh grade is just the worst. And so I was wondering, like, what would you do if you were that that the obviously she fucked up in the sense that she shouldn't, this shouldn't have come out now. Like, this is something that should have been reckoned with earlier. But for whatever reason, that didn't happen. And so give, if you're in that situation now, or say you're the principal and the theater teacher says, look, I had cut some of this stuff out, but I insist that we use it. What do you do?
I mean, so I don't know how this stuff tends to work, right? So I didn't know, for instance, that you couldn't just get the rights to the play and make changes. I'm curious as to how they even found, like, you know, what caused this to become an issue.
There are rules when it comes to theater. There are rules that the playwright leaves about what you can and can't do with the play in terms of adapting it. And probably my guess is that one of his rules was they have to actually say the N-word, because it sounded like, from the way my daughter described it, they could cut it for time because there's no way they could do the whole play. But they couldn't not have people say the N-word, precisely, I guess, because of it's such a racially charged slur.
Right, like, as you say, that's the point of the whole.
It's a play about racism. It makes no sense if the characters aren't racist.
Right. So I, you know, I'm torn about this, because obviously the solution is, you know, I wouldn't pick this as a play for seventh grade. But that aside, now you're left. I can't blame the teacher too much for not wanting sort of, you know, little seventh graders to spew the N word, just because. You know, I mean, there's a weird effect where people might hear it and they hear it coming out of someone's mouth, and they attribute it kind of to them, to the person, and not to the situation and all of that. You just might want to protect kids from having to, just like you might want to protect them from doing a play in which they have to, like, act out violent or acts or do something kind of otherwise that you wouldn't want seventh graders to be doing. That said, I would want to bite the bullet, print out an explanation,
yes,
on the front of the program,
right,
and say that we thought it was super important for kids to realize how hurtful that was at the time, but nonetheless not hide how hurtful it was. And then, you know, you even make some attempt at having a discussion amongst the kids,
right? I mean,
about this.
It could be an opportunity for dialogue. It could be an opportunity for the thing that we love so much is when people are brought together and to try to just get other people's perspectives.
Another thing I think, is, like, it would have been nice. I mean, you know, it's obviously easier said than done, so I'm not going to judge that particular teacher. But bring in the parents of the kids, and especially if there are African American kids and parents,
have plenty.
A discussion and make a decision, sort of as a group, right?
Yeah.
Like and especially with the African American parents, they might actually feel. I suspect they'd feel strongly that they ought to keep it in, right?
I don't know about these particular parents,
right.
But that's what I would think too. I would have been happier, frankly, if at least the principal, like, I could understand it more if the principal just said, look, there's too much I have to deal with right now to get angry letters every day from parents about this. Like, I don't know. So, but I agree with you, like, this. Like, what do you, if you're doing To Kill a Mockingbird, right, and you think that is a project worth undertaking, then it seems like it shouldn't be beyond the pale at that point to really do it and to do what you can to make sure the kids behave responsibly. The only reservation I have, so I was taking my daughter and one of her friends home, and she was saying how her brothers saw that movie, the Jackie Robinson movie, what was it, 42. You know, there's a lot of N-words in that movie, and then they were just saying it, like, you know, because they're kids, they're like they're sixth, fifth, whatever graders, like, they don't get it. And so, and they got grounded. And so there's a question, and I wonder if this sort of connects back to the discussion with Paul about the difference between boys and girls. Like, right. There might be that boys at this age just can't, they just don't have the mental resources to handle
not, like,
it majorly.
Do karate kicks as they're like leaving a movie. Yeah. And like, I mean,
that's the only thing I can't speak to. Like, I know, I don't think Eliza fully understood the gravity of the decision, but like, I know for sure that she could handle it, you know, and that, right. that actually it would be a good learning experience for her to really feel what's like. So I think it would have been really good for her, but you know, I still think I would have tried to do it. At least tried. At least, I mean, time pressure is the problem. Now they have to mount a totally new play, and they so that she had to make a quick decision. So getting all the parents together right. and all of that.
Are they going for Huck Finn? Huck Finn?
No, they're doing 12 Angry Men.
Oh, wow.
So my poor daughter. Like, they go from, like, a play that she's the star in to a play where there are just no women in it. I mean, she's like, she'll probably be one of the people, but...
What if they call it 12 Angry People and then they get a letter saying, no, it has to be men?
That'd be hilarious.
This is actually where, you know, I mean, for our listeners who are African American, like, I'm curious what you think... And not that I'm not curious what non-African-Americans think.
If you are not African-American, just save it. We don't want to hear it.
Shut the fuck up. No, that's an interesting dilemma. I think that I would have, in that position, not even tried it, I think.
Yeah. She's a young teacher. You know, this is a big learning experience, I think.
Right.
She, like, didn't really understand what the...
So is she white?
She is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another interesting question. Like, if she were African-American, could she have gotten away right. with it? Yeah. Or not just gotten away with it, but, like, more likely to have, I don't know, the credibility to do a project like that? And if that's true politically, could that... Is that, like, is that an... Right. There's a lot of interesting issues with this, frankly.
Yeah.
Like,
the other thing I'm thinking is, you know, I mean, it is really the case that at the point where you remove the racism from To Kill a Mockingbird, then what's the point of the play? But I do wonder if the insistence on keeping the N-word rather than allowing for some other marker that would maintain the insulting nature of it without,
yeah,
you know.
To be fair to what they had done to it, it's not like you don't get that people are racist in that town. It's right. just that you don't really see the depths of it or, like, you know, just how commonplace it was. But I think, and I didn't go through the whole play as they had cut it or edited it, but, like, you know, it is still a black man on trial for right. and for harming, not raping. I mean, yeah. Before I even knew it was even a remote possibility that they couldn't do the play, I had just sort of ethical problems with the cuts they were making. But I still think it was there. It was just in really sanitized form. And maybe Foote was right to say, no, you can't do that. You can't make this. You can't drain the real tension out of the play and make.
I wonder if they changed the lines from busting up a chiffon robe to breaking up a dresser. Sorry. That's a very obscure line of the book. But that's what she asks him to come inside and do, to bust up the chiffon robe.
Speaking of obscure lines from books, how about Angela pulling out a line from Lolita? We'll talk about that.
Which I think is central to what's... Okay, yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the second topic, which is maybe more...
Even more painful than the history of racism in this country.
So, I was trying to figure out, like, the best movie or TV metaphor for what's happening in your field right now. As, like, obviously, like, my first thought was, like, a zombie apocalypse or or just a plain old apocalypse. Like, and this is the end where, like, the ground starts caving in and people starts falling down, like, into the pit or...
I mean, here's where I pull a Tamler and say that the rumors of the death of social psychology have been greatly exaggerated.
How is that pulling a me?
because your primary complaint usually when we talk about the chilling effect of like free speech violations is that it just doesn't happen as nearly, it's not nearly as common as everybody writes about. Like, it's not like it's something that's that much of a problem.
Yeah.
And I think that does apply here. Like, I think this is like a small minority of people throwing rotten fruit at each other.
Okay, so let me finish my movie metaphors, please. So the other thing I was thinking, speaking of, of small group of people, Reservoir Dogs, at the final scene, you know, where they're all kind of shooting each other and everyone dies.
Yeah, yeah. The that's a good one. The good old Mexican standoff.
Yeah, the Mexican standoff, exactly. Then I thought just Bridget Jones's Baby, that new movie. Just not, it doesn't, like, I don't know, obviously I haven't seen the movie, but just...
I don't know if it's that obvious.
The thought, I haven't even the thought, like, of actually seeing that movie seems so devastating and kind of horrifying that, like, that maybe that would capture it. But here's what I thought the best analogy would be, which is pretty much every season of The Wire, where the tragedy of The Wire... of all the seasons, really, is like a matter of fate, right? It's this clash of individual interests, your incentives for promoting your own self-interest, and what's right for the job. And it does seem like at the bottom of whatever issue there is, and I know you'll try to minimize it, but at the bottom of whatever issue there is, it's this tension between the incentives for scientists and what would count as good science. All right. So why don't you describe what's been going on, and then you can respond and defend your discipline.
Well, to be fair, so there's a meta issue, which is all of the people involved in this are generally from my discipline. So both the people who are trying to correct, so we're talking about the replication, like the replication crisis, if you want to call it that, and the various methodological problems that have emerged in the field of psychology in general and many social psychology results specifically. So Susan Fiske, who is the APS past president of the Psychological Association, wrote a letter, and she wrote a letter, and it was going to go in the next issue of the APS Observer, which is their professional publication, in the last, I don't know, couple of years, as the criticisms of these methodologies and all the p-hacking, all the stuff that Tamler's always talking about, as those mounted, the critiques that have been leveled against particular studies and particular researchers have been mounted primarily by a group of individuals who have been leveling these critiques on social media, so Twitter, their blog posts. To be fair to them, I don't know where else you would do this unless, you know, the whole point of some of the critiques is that the way that the science is currently done is problematic, and if you want to get that through peer review, it seems as if that's not the right venue anyway. To mount these critiques. So there have been pretty vocal people who have pointed out these criticisms publicly. And there have been cases in which individuals have been singled out for having results that have failed to replicate. People like Roy Baumeister and John Barge, like big names in the field. And then also people like who are not such big names. But at some point, people started calling these vocal opponents of flawed methodology replication bullies, and there
that was Dan Gilbert.
Yeah, and the most ironic thing is that a field that has documented in-group out-group processes so well, like going back to the 50s, is right now suffering from like the worst case of Red Sox Yankees that I've seen.
So why do you say that? Did you didn't say the methodological terrorists line.
Yeah, so I was going to say, so in this letter that was to be published in APS Observer, not yet published, somebody posted a link to copy on Dropbox, which we'll link to. And in that letter, Susan Fiske basically says, look, people are being assholes in the way that they're handling these problems is by taking to social media and calling out names And I'm not going to call out names, but you know who you are. You're methodological terrorists, right?
And socio-destructo critics or something like that. Yeah, there were a lot of different labels for
destructo critic. So there's a lot that Fisk says that it's not unreasonable. I mean, there's if it's a plea for people to be more like kinder to each other, and but she lost it, I think, when she said basically her beef was that by posting on social media, it's unmoderated. And if you're going to like mount critiques at other scientists, it should be on a forum that is somehow
peer reviewed
or at least monitored by people in the field.
Right.
And so her argument is that this kind of criticism is destructive and not constructive. And so she says, not only that, but like people like us in APS have been a leader in encouraging robust methods and transparency. But these self-appointed, quote, the self-appointed destructive critics role now includes public shaming and blaming, often implying dishonesty on the part of the target and other innuendo based on unchecked assumptions. Targets often seem to be chosen for scientifically irrelevant reasons, their contrary opinions, professional prominence, or career stage vulnerability. The destructo critics are ignoring ethical rules of conduct because they circumvent constructive peer review.
By ethical, she means the things that keep the status quo and the establishment in place. And
it's a little bit of Cry Me a River when she says that they're being picked for irrelevant reasons, such as their prominence.
From an outsider's perspective, it reads a little like you people outside the club don't get to question our methods, even if they are, you know, objectively questionable.
Right.
You have to go through us to do that. You have to, and we have to approve any criticisms that you make of our methodology and our practices.
Right. And so there is something that you might argue where you don't want to air the dirty laundry of the small critiques of your field. But there is here's where I think it's completely misguided. So that she uses the term methodological terrorism, which everybody, I mean, that's just tone deaf.
She took that out, right? I think it's not going to be in the final draft. Is that right?
I don't exactly know, because the final draft has not been published. So they said that it was in the process of being copy edited. What would you do? Would you take it out now if you were her?
I don't know. This guy will post a link to it, but Andrew Gelman pointed out, like, first response was, methodological terrorism is when you publish a paper in a peer-reviewed journal. Its claim is supported by a statistically significant statistic of 5.03, and someone looks at your numbers, figures out that the correct value is 1.8, and then posts that correction on social media. Terrorism is when someone blows shit up and tries to kill you. So that's kind of my sort of
And we'll link to Andrew Gelman's post, which funnily does actually engage in name calling, like calling out specific people. There are two issues. One is whether or not critiques should be leveled by, you know, on social media and unmoderated forums. The other one is, should people be dicks to each other? And I actually think that the answer is obviously no, people shouldn't be dicks to each other. But I also think that many people who are leveling these criticisms, who are, I would say, the younger generation of psychologists who are trying to improve the dialogue, some of whom listened to Very Bad Wizards, people like Daniel Akins and
Yoel is Samin, part of this.
Yoel, right? Samin Vizier, Sanjay Srivastava. I never have known them to be sort of name calling and doing anything but actually making critical comments about methods that sometimes are sparked by a particular paper. But this is my point, which I can just make simply and elegantly rather than rambling. The whole point of science is that anybody can make critiques.
Yeah.
That is, once you learn the methods and once you know how to do it, it doesn't matter if you're a 16-year-old prodigy in the fucking slums of Bombay or whether you are, you know, fancy professor at Princeton University. If you are right and you find a way to communicate it, other people should listen, right? There is, it's a great leveler. Like, this science is a great leveler. So to the extent that we have to tear down the fucking guard of whatever, like the hierarchy that is allowing some people's voices to be better than others, then let's do it. That's what the internet is about. That's exactly what the internet is about. And if you don't like that Daniel Akins called you out for your shitty F statistic, which to be completely fair, there's so many papers that I probably wrote that could be called out because we didn't know. Like, we just didn't know how to do good science. To me, it's just like, you know what? Just shut up and move on and do good work.
But so
do good work.
Here's the problem with that is, how does that – I mean, so ideally what you're talking about is how science is supposed to work. And like, ideally, if somebody figures out that, you know, your statistical power of your study was less than you thought it was, or that your effect doesn't replicate, like, you should be happy. Now we have a greater understanding of the truth, and here we had less of an understanding, so we've moved forward. But the incentives in the discipline don't function that way. A, there's not an incentive to produce negative results, but there's a big incentive to produce positive results. B, really being careful, unwilling to publish results that you're not absolutely confident will hold up, that would reduce your productivity and that would harm your career. And so there's did you see this article in The Atlantic about this model that someone ran? But I guess it's Paul Smaldino and Richard McElrath, where they ran a formal model to try to show that it will always, the standards for good science, given the conditions of how this the incentive policy is set up, will always degrade to the point where you really can't trust the results from that science. So, like, everybody getting an attitude adjustment doesn't seem like is that's not going to solve this problem. The actual, like, from the bottom up, like, this is, it actually is kind of relevant to Mr. Robot. It's like the whole structure has to change in a way that it would be monumental to undertake, or at least there would be there's a lot of established interests that would stand against.
Yeah, there is established interest. I mean, there are a couple questions here. One is whether there is a way to distinguish true from false findings given the way that we currently do science. And I think that there is. I mean, this is the whole point of these critiques has been for us to pay attention as a field more to unpublished studies, like things like the file door problem, to train researchers to think about these researcher degrees of freedom and p-hacking, to not rely solely on the significance testing that we've been doing. And as journals actually increase their rigor in what to accept and what not to accept, which has already happened, there is no doubt in my mind that we will be less likely to publish false results. The thing about the incentives that you're talking about, I think, is absolutely a problem. It's a problem in every science. I think in other sciences, people have a better sense of, well, like, for instance, this guy, John Ioannidis, who published a very influential paper saying that most published research results are false. When you apply that to, like, medical science, I think people have a sense right away, well, that sucks, but as long as we keep doing it right, we'll find out what's true, because there is a truth of the matter as to whether broccoli causes cancer or whatever. Like, we'll find that out. I think in psychology, there's a bit more Schadenfreude that's going on, which is, it was all bunk to begin with, and there is no amount of fixing this because the mind is just not empirically available to us.
I don't have that Schadenfreude, all joking aside, because... Yeah. Social psychology results are cool. Like, yeah. They're fun. They're fun for philosophers, certainly, to work into their theories, and they're fun to teach. You know, it's fun to see a bunch of students perk up when you start showing them Milgram experiments,
right?
Or, you know, the the phone booth study with the dime and, you know,
and
helping behaviors. I think unlike biology or medicine, where we definitely have like real documented progress over a long period of time, it's less clear that we have that with psychology, or if we do, it's harder to identify for sure that we have it. Like, you can identify, look, like in 1950, all these people were dying of this disease, and now they're no longer dying of that disease. You know, that's pretty easy to prove, but it's harder with some of the more famous results in social psychology.
Why I think that really the mistake has always been to rely on a finding or a paper. And I think that absolutely progress has been made in understanding the mind at every level. And some of these results really are robust. It's just a fact that, for instance, dividing people into in-groups and out-groups makes them treat each other shittier, right? There's enough studies on that holds up. And there are enough studies showing that we have asymmetries in the way we judge ourselves versus others. Those things hold up. But that's because we have a body of literature showing. Right. And it's hard to tell when it might hold up in this particular case or not. But I think we also overestimate the degree to which there's consensus in things like medical science. So if you trace the history of is salt intake good or bad for you, right? You're going to see, like, there's just probably no consensus. Like, there's all kinds of research findings that say one thing versus another, caffeine, the same thing. And I think that there's just a ton of those. That's why I think that the assumptions that because we have you know, we can save people's lives in a way that we couldn't 100 years ago, it's more obvious. The successes are more obvious. The uncertainty in the field of, say, nutritional science and medicine and all those things is less salient to us. But I think it's just, you know, there was recently, what was that? Do you remember this? There was like a hoax, like some German researchers published something saying that chocolate helped you lose weight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that, you know, that was like a hoax to show that you can basically argue anything and get it past scientific scrutiny.
That's why I think it's not Schadenfreude as much as disillusionment, maybe like losing a religion or something like that. It used to be that people would say, oh, if I just power pose, I'll be more successful. Or, you know, if I eat chocolate, I'll lose weight. And then now you're telling me those things don't work, actually. Fuck this. I don't know what to trust anymore.
Right.
But
that doesn't stop you from, say, taking the advice of your doctor, right?
Right. No, right. And that's a good point. You don't really have to trust a social psychologist to get on in life, but you have to go to a doctor, right?
As evidenced by our interactions. So you don't have to trust me at all. I think, okay, and then there's the second point that I think is really important, which is, like, you're right about the incentive structure, and I think this is the growing pains that we're going through right now, is that those incentive structures are becoming derailed because of the great equalizer that is the internet. And I think that the minute you have now people who can read, you can post data and reply to them, to the authors, and you're going to get people, say, all over the world, maybe even whose motivation is just to be a dick and take you down. But if their critique is right, we now can't shut them up.
Right.
Right. And so, yeah, of course, there's dicks who are like trying to take down, right? Like, there are people who are on a takedown mission. And I think that's what Susan Fiske is pissed about, you know, destructo critics.
Right, and she's probably right about some people, right? There probably are some bitter outsiders who are taking pleasure in it or who are being meaner than they could be about it. But that doesn't undermine the fact
that there are
serious problems and that a lot of these people are doing it for the right reasons. And even if they're not doing it for the right reasons, the issue is still a real issue.
Right. So, you know, like another scientist, like we like, I don't care if Einstein discovered, you know, the E equals MC squared because he was really pissed at some other scientist. Right. Like it doesn't like it stands.
Because he wanted to like sleep with his best friend's wife.
Right, right. Because his mother treated him bad. What will become interesting, though, is how the people who are seeing themselves as the rebel outsiders who are leading the charge, people like Arberio and Yoel, who are leading the charge. And
oh, yeah, the outsider at the University of Toronto.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. When they become the guard, what responsibility will they carry when they are now the people that everybody listens to?
So the metaphor for that is probably Animal Farm or any movie where the outsider gains power and becomes exactly like the people that they're replacing.
Right. Like, let's, you know, there are already people who are dogmatic in their Bayesianism because, you know, and so we'll see. They're like Angela on Mr. Robot. Will power transform them?
This is like your Arab Spring, and so the next step is like the authoritarian leader or the just, you know, the anarchy or the Donald Trump or whatever. So, yeah. so you have that to look forward to.
It is really funny, though, that like so much of the bitterness expressed is about the fact that people can post on blogs.
Yeah. I know.
Thank God Susan Fiske isn't listening to podcasts about this.
And really, the other thing is, like, you know, this stuff with philosophy that's going on. Like, we also have a fucked up incentive structure that rewards productivity. And so
no ability to determine what is true or not.
Right. And no ability. And, like, the product, you know, the pressures to be productive just means that everyone's going to do fussy little objections and counterexamples and all of that. And I've carried on enough about that. But that stuff has been that debate has been going on for a long time, whereas it feels like social psychology, there's been a huge crunch precisely because of the internet that's really come to a head in the last 10 years, like, or 5 years or whatever. This is something that blog post by Andrew, like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even people barely heard of the right. Like, we probably, you go back like 2012, 2013, we're not talking about that in our podcast, you know. I would have had I known about it.
No, it's true. And I think that you should read Andrew Gelman's post because he does outline a nice timeline of this stuff. I think that social psychology wasn't until the Malcolm Gladwell sort of popularizing us, that people started even paying that much attention to it. And guess what? Like, now that is the curse of having all that external criticism.
Yeah.
Or those eyeballs that came along with the fame.
It's all Malcolm Gladwell's fault.
And he got rich off of it. No. I mean, there's some sense.
You all got rich over it. Look at
right,
you.
Daryl Bem, who was in our department, right? I was actually hired on replacement money from Daryl Bem, the guy who published the ESP studies. He was, as Gelman points out, one of the big precipitating factors, because he published this paper on ESP that was basically like using our own methods, you know, rigorous methods, like rigorous in, you know, 1998 terms, he showed that ESP was possible, and to disagree with him, you had to basically abandon the validity of those techniques. So, like,
you had to be a methodological terrorist to disagree with him.
Exactly. This is the worst metaphor in the world. In the world, but
in the science, and you people in power.
Wait, am I someone in power? I don't know anymore whether I'm old or young. This is very confusing.
Well, you are at an Ivy League psychology department.
Yeah, it's true.
You're
at
the same
therefore
institution that Robert Frank and Dirk Parabou.
Nobody knows that Cornell is an Ivy, let's be honest. All right.
Let's take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about our other two topics, although we've gone a little long on this. Yeah. Thank you.
Welcome back to Very Bad Wizards. First, we're going to start talking about Mr. Robot in this segment. We said that we were going to talk about four topics, and we realized that we just got carried away talking about science and To Kill a Mockingbird. So we are going to save the topic that we had planned out for another future episode.
I also think that could be a bigger episode. Like
it could be its own paper. Second, we had, and I think we mentioned at the end of last episode, we had planned, and we in fact did talk to science journalist Matt Hudson, who was kind enough to come on and talk to us about just what it is like being a science journalist and a variety of other issues. But we had some audio problems, and it just wasn't going to work out. We couldn't salvage it. So we're going to ask him to come back at a future.
Yeah, we had a whole conversation with him. Hour-long conversation with them. And I think that's why you were a little easier on journalists in the last segment is...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't bring it up. He knows. Yeah, it was... I maintain.
David blames everything that's going wrong with his field on science journalism. No,
they're merely one
cause. You really
cause.
Have from the beginning. That's something that you've done. Yeah.
I think it's one cause, but it gets to that structure of incentives that you were talking about. And so, you know, who doesn't want to get published in popular press?
Truth. That's all I'm motivated by.
Right. This is the moment at the beginning of the second segment where we like to thank our listeners for all the support they've given us. Thank you so much for all the emails, the reviews, the tweets. I really feel like we're experiencing a bit of growth here. Getting a steady stream of comments, all of which we, of course, love. The Patreon supporters, thank you so much.
Thank you. We have almost 200 Patreon supporters. We're like at 195. So
that's
between
insane.
Now and our 100th episode, if we could get to 200 Patreon supporters,
that would be amazing. And so if you want to support us, go to patreon.com/verybadwizards. There are other ways to support us that we have in our support page, verybadwizards.com/support, such as buying stuff by clicking through our Amazon link. So thank you for doing that. A number of you have emailed us to tell us, and sure enough, it's a nice little Christmas bonus for
us.
Just
got a Roku using that link.
Sweet. And you can email us verybadwizards@gmail.com or tweet at us @verybadwizards, @Tamler, @Peas. And yeah.
Like us on Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
Rate us on iTunes.
Review us on iTunes. We got a bunch of good reviews.
Awesome reviews. Let's talk about it. Yeah. And download us on iTunes so we can move up in the rankings.
so the Tamler can. Even if you're on Linux. Even if you're on Linux, find a way.
Rate us on Linux, yeah.
Now, for those of you, I wanted to say one thing, if you will permit me, Tamler, the one last thing about the discussion in the previous segment.
Yes.
Which is...
I will permit.
Thank you. Father, may I. Which is one of the things that I think Susan Fiske is saying in her column that I think is just wrong is that somehow it's a mistaken view that I mean, it's nice to say that we should be nice to each other, but at just a purely descriptive level, for hundreds of years, science has never been nice. Science is not nice. There have been assholes and dicks since the moment we started claiming things. And the whole point is that it doesn't matter what your character is. Newton and Leibniz were both probably assholes, but like everybody can agree that like, you know, they made serious progress in calculus.
Wait, Leibniz? Are you lumping Leibniz in?
No, because of their beef about calculus. I don't know whether it was. I'm saying they could have been royal assholes. Like, I'm sure they were. They had beef with each other. The point is, like, it's
Did
always
Leibniz make
been
contributions,
true.
Though?
To calculus, which is mathematics, right?
Is that what that is?
Yeah, that's what
I've
referring
to. Seen
that
word.
I mean, you usually have seen it with a pre- Right before it. it's like pre-calculus, but after that.
No, I've always seen it after utilitarian.
It's a weird expectation that we would ever be really nice to each other as I'm not saying that this in any way means that we should be assholes, but it is, we've been pretty protected as a field if we've not experienced the wrath of some jerk. And I think that that's just unfortunately.
So David's final conclusion and recommendation is be mean to people, call them assholes, call them dicks. Assholes.
Because
then you'll be like Isaac Newton.
If you fucking discover the laws of gravity, you know, you pretty much can call anybody whatever you want. But science isn't nice, I guess. That's just the harsh truth. Science is red in tooth and claw. And with that, let's move on.
Philosophers, though, very nice. So all you people super looking nice to go into that minefield,
especially nice to women. Especially nice to young women. It's tradition.
Mr. Robot, second season, polarizing a little bit. I've gotten a lot of people like saying, defend your show to me. I'm prepared to do that. I think both of us have gone through a bit of a roller coaster in terms of how we feel about this. Let's start before we even get into.
I like how serious we take it.
I do take it very seriously. I mean, like we really went hard for this show, right? Like our credibility is
it's more at stake than Sam Esmail's.
It's really interesting. I don't know if you've seen him interviewed after the show, like after the finale, but just to see him on shows talking about it, like that's one of the things I want to get to. What happened this season if you take it on a purely straightforward level? I have found that the dominant reaction to the finale was everything is on the level right now. There are questions that we don't know about, but like there's no fucking time travel, there's no alternate universes, there's no like
so
question
far
as to the reality of any character right now. Let's walk through the show as if they're right about that, and then we can talk about some open-ended questions.
Okay, so you want to give it a stab? I mean, part of it is
I was hoping you would.
Yeah.
So Elliot wakes up. The season starts. This is one of the, I think, the issues with the season, with Elliot living with his mom, isolated, separated from the rest of F society, and trying to get rid of Mr. Robot by disconnecting himself from all internet, you know, like access to a computer, everything. So he's just living at his mom's, who had not been a character on the show. We didn't even know if she was alive or not. And so he's now living with her.
Yeah, in a very stoic sort of stripped down existence. Yeah. He writes in his notebook, he's gone analog. He's gone full analog in the hopes that Mr. Robot won't rear his head because there's no reason for him to, because the hacking was his primary motivation. The hack's been done. We don't know what's gone on since the
end. We don't know what happened with Tyrell. Then he's also just watching basketball with a guy named Leon and gets involved with another guy named Ray, who's played by Craig Robinson, who's awesome.
Right. And Leon is Joey Badass, the rapper.
He's good.
He's good.
So
there's a fascination with Seinfeld for some reason. They're watching basketball games in the park.
It's all very strange, and I think it matters whether you go on Reddit and look at the
look at the
discussion on Reddit or not. But even after the first episode, somebody brought up that they thought Elliot was in prison or in a mental institution. And as soon as that enters your mind and then you go back and watch even the first episode, it seems obviously true.
Yeah.
Like that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. It's the power of the internet.
That's the power of the internet. After it was revealed to be actually the case, like the Reddit people were like, we did it. We solved it. I actually think so next year I pledge to not go on Reddit, because then once you know after the first episode that that's the deal, you don't know maybe the details. Is Ray the warden? You know, like what's Joey? Why is Joey Badass having lunch with him and all the meals with him every single day? Like you don't know the exact details about that part, but you know that this whole thing with him and his mom, that's not real. And And so, it, you know, the fact that you don't find out for sure for another four or five episodes, for some reason, was a little more frustrating than last year when you knew that Mr. Robot wasn't real. Like, I don't know. Like, I was willing to let them reveal that whenever they wanted to reveal it. But this was frustrating for some reason. Like, okay, can we just have it be clear that he's in prison right now? I think part of the issue was that the reason he put himself in prison turns out to be that this was the only way he thought he could get rid of Mr. Robot, but their interactions weren't that interesting to me while he's in prison or while he's, you know, in his delusion of not prison. Like, none of that stuff was interesting. Them playing chess with each other. There was beautiful, like, scenes and, like, really cool, you know, filming and the cinematography was
cinematography incredible. This season was amazing.
Off the charts.
Yeah.
So, like, you could enjoy it at that level, but I didn't enjoy it as a like, I didn't feel like it developed his character anymore. I knew that he was uncomfortable and was going to try to get rid of Mr. Robot, but that he couldn't really, like, I didn't need five episodes, part of which were devoted to, like, driving that point home even further. So that
right.
was, I guess, I think what got a lot of people a little annoyed, whether they knew that the prison thing was going on or not, like, that was a little annoying.
Yeah.
Meanwhile.
And I think you're right. I mean, I disagree about the, I'm going to continue reading Reddit because I think so much of what the journey of this show is through Esmail's desire to plant clues throughout. But that said, I agree that the pacing of this mystery and reveal was just too long, and we could have gotten through it much quicker.
But, you know, a lot of people were like, holy shit, that's awesome, when they found out that. And, you know, the reason we didn't think that, it's not because we were so smart, because we read it on Reddit. And I think it's fairly obvious once that idea is planted in your head.
It's totally obvious. But again, I think that your analogy to season one is the right one, where we all kind of figured out from episode one that Mr. Robot wasn't real, and that wasn't revealed to us, but we knew. I just think that the pacing of that mystery reveal was tighter.
Yeah,
like, there was character development through, even though you knew that it was true,
but you didn't know, like, why, like, what was going on, and you were interested as to how this was happening. And
in some ways, I think that spending that much time with the development of the prison life of Elliot is an unclear payoff. And we can talk when we talk theories. Yeah. Like, I think that there might have been a reason to spend that much time on it, but it's not clear by the end.
No.
Why.
And there's, like, this side plot with Craig Robinson, where he's running some Silk Road style website where, you know, it's like a black market for any horrible thing. And that just seemed like not necessary. That just seemed like it didn't advance the plot. It was somewhat in, just because if you love Craig Robinson and you just love
who I saw at a party. Just I want to say
that's
for the record,
which is awesome.
Yeah, totally.
Like, when you're an established social psychologist, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, all these blockers are trying to take down my fame.
These methodological terrorists get in the way of you, like, hanging out with Craig Robinson. So meanwhile, there's a new FBI agent that we meet, Dom.
Who's awesome.
She's great. She's played by Meryl Streep's daughter.
Which I didn't know for a while that it was Meryl Streep's daughter.
You couldn't tell just by looking at her. She looks exactly.
I mean, after I found out, but you know,
That one, I was the Reddit person. I knew from just I didn't have to read that was Meryl Streep's daughter.
There's an FBI investigation ongoing about the hack. She is kind of at the street level, you know, at the street level investigator. You know,
we think,
Sure, there's a mini trope there about the dedicated agent who is going to solve the mystery,
but he's lonely.
So her life is completely devoted to this case, but she seems to be making progress despite the higher ups not caring.
She's a McNulty kind of figure.
She's a McNulty.
She's not
her alcohol
social.
Is Alexa. Amazon's Alexa.
Yes, that's right. And we get a lot of scenes between her and Alexa, and
a great masturbation scene.
Yes.
God, that was so, that was just was an awesome scene. It yeah. was great because whether or not you find it sexually appealing, it is, it characterized a particular loneliness.
Yeah.
Right. It was just so, I thought it was very well done.
Yeah. So, okay. That you have that. You have Angela getting deeper into Evil Corp, but also you're wondering still, like, what's her plan here? Like, is she yeah. really just decided, people don't respect me, so I am going to be a big shot at Evil Corp or at E Corp, you know, like this, and I'm going to try to win over Philip Price, and I'm really excited about going on a date with him? Or is she... does she have something planned?
Is she infiltrating, right? Yeah. It's unclear, I think, throughout, probably throughout. Intentionally. And, but yeah. but I found that actually to be a frustrating aspect of it. Like,
oh, see, I actually kind of liked that. Yeah. That's interesting. I think we might split on the Angela plot because yeah. I actually found that to be maybe the most compelling thing of the whole season. And I like yeah. her. I like that actress, Portia Doubleday. And so... what else? So Darlene and F Society are trying to capitalize. It's clear that the hack didn't quite, wasn't right, yet, like didn't bring them everything that they wanted. Evil Corp right. seems like they're, like the government's kind of kissing their ass. Philip Price, Jack, you know, he can get the government to do whatever he wants them to do, although they'll put a little, they'll be a little annoying sometimes, but he'll still tell them to like wipe their mouth. Right. And
I think importantly that what's shown is that the presumed sort of liberation of the common person that was the stated intention of these F Society hackers actually did not have, like, it just didn't have that intended effect. That in fact people's debts haven't really been erased. They're being enforced by the bank. With no evidence. So E-Corp is trying to actually maintain control of the financial world by introducing their own electronic currency and still keeping control over the finances of the masses. So you see actually not a lot, but some key scenes where the common person is getting sort of screwed over.
And really no scenes where the common person is benefiting from this.
Right, right.
Just zero scenes where that's
a lot
happening.
Of trash can fires, like to lot, indicate. Like,
yeah, there's like trash can fires, but there's also like a guy who makes good sandwiches going out of business because nobody can pay for it. So like the whole thing just seems like as of yet there hasn't been any upside. So meanwhile, the FBI investigation takes them to China. And Dom has this interaction with White Rose, who we find out is also like the chief finance minister of, is it finance minister of China, and then is almost killed by what we assume are dark army agents who then shoot themselves. So things pick up mid-season after the prison thing is revealed, where you find right. out that Elliot was in prison, but now he's getting released because he's brought... like, this is how inconsequential the whole Silk Road kind of thing was, is... like, I had to think for a second, wait, why did Elliot get out of prison? Oh, yeah, because he brought down that Silk Road website, but, like...
We never talked about this, I don't think, even off the air, but... wasn't it sort of interesting that that the warden's story about how he had vowed to never look at what was being sold?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? I found that pretty intriguing, and it made me actually more sympathetic to him for some, you know, for purely irrational reasons, because like he ought to have. I mean, it's like gross negligence.
I promised never to look at the... the methodology behind the study.
I believe you. Yeah, and the story about his wife, you know, and I mean, maybe it's just Craig Robinson is so likable, but
I think that's what it is. Like he could be, like, there's nothing that he could be doing short of like hurting a member of my family that I wouldn't
right.
be like. And he
knew that he was getting yeah. himself caught. Right. I think that once it became real to him what he was doing.
And he seemed to have like a connection with Elliot, like a genuine connection with Elliot that was Like, in fact, to me, more interesting than anything that was going on between him and Mr. Robot.
Right.
This is a big flaw for me for the season, is their dynamic in the whole time while he's in prison, to me, was not in it. Like, I wanted it to get to Angela or Dom or Darlene.
Right.
Or whatever.
And it was, yeah. I think it was just too drawn out. Yeah. Right, there was a point to be made there that they're at war with each other, yeah. And we got hit over the head with the chess metaphor. Interestingly, like, once that's done and we get to Darlene and Angela, we were given an episode even where he never makes an appearance.
Right.
And I never thought that would be good.
Yeah, but it was really good. And that was where, like, things started to pick up in the season in terms of,
right.
Like, oh my God, there's a story.
Right, and this is where the pacing went to sort of like 11 on the meter for me. Yeah. Like it just got good.
It got really right. good, and
so we're privy to.
We haven't even talked about Alf and that whole thing.
I gotta give it to Esmail. Like it was risky, and when I was watching that episode where, you know, it's like Full House parody 80s sitcom, I was uncomfortable, not because of the plot, but because I was like, please tell me that he's not going to bomb this episode. I was rooting for Esmail to pull it off because I was so worried that this was like a jump the shark moment.
So it went on for like 20 minutes, but then there was I think that's the same episode that there was that awesome, like, Angela planting the, was it the femtocell?
The femtocell, yeah.
Yeah. And that was so cool. That was like, that was kind of like Tarantino style filming. And that was, so that sort of.
Super, like, tense, like heist kind of tense, you know?
I don't think the Alf thing worked and the 90s Full House thing worked fully just because of the existence of Too Many Cooks. Had there not been Too Many Cooks 2 years ago or whatever, or 1 year ago, whenever it was, I would have thought, okay, that's cool. Like, you know, they tried to fit it in thematically with the characters, but you know, that given that sort of has been done, not just the Natural Born Killers thing where it's like dark but funny, but literally those same comic beats have been done, and like in some ways, Too Many Cooks did it, like they really drew it out in ways that were more interesting then.
Yeah, but it's such a different thing that's being done. Like, I think that maybe the recency is what makes it feel like a copy rather than an homage. But I think that if you treat it, but there's a couple of things that I think make it actually okay. One is that this is the mind of somebody like at around a certain age.
Right.
Your mind is full of shit like that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that there is an incredible tension about, I mean, this was the reveal for Mr. Robot telling Elliot that they had killed Tyrell. That was the way that it was revealed to us.
Not in the sitcom.
No, but that tale with the juxtaposition of Tyrell in the trunk.
Yeah.
You know, crying out is how we were kind of viscerally told the story that basically they had done this to Tyrell.
Yeah.
Which I still believe, by the way, actually, but
we'll talk about that. Yeah. Cause you're in the minority there.
I am. And yeah.
So, which is funny. Like, we've kind of switched places here. Now you're weirdo stoner. And I'm like, I think we just got to accept that things are a little more straightforward. I'm like, I'm Yoel.
Your weed just got a little weaker. I think you're so.
I'm going to get a new weed guy. So here's my, I have ambivalent about the whole Alf thing. Like, I think the comic elements of it didn't work as well for me because of Too Many Cooks. But I get that, like, I thought the thematic stuff and the character-based stuff did work. Like, it seemed a little too proud of itself that it was the way that it was parodying it. Like,
they even ran old commercials.
Yeah, I know. And it didn't, like, that, like, I,
So I never read it as funny. I was incredibly tense throughout the whole scene and didn't even... Part of what I thought that it showed, which is not storytelling, but was Rami Malek's like absolute sort of ability to...
Not blink
and just maintain a level of dread and confusion through what is the most absurd... absurd set of circumstances that they're filming, right?
No, I agree. And so that's fine. Like I'm glad that he wants to take chances like that. He also built it up. Like, this is one of the problems with, like, getting involved with it outside of the episode. If that had just popped up, but, like, Sam Esmail was saying, like, this is my favorite episode that we've done, which is crazy. Like, it's, like, whatever you want to say about it, like, it doesn't compare to the Prison Break episode. So I was all amped up. Like, and because you also think you're going to finally fucking figure out what's going on in this season.
Right.
And you don't even figure that out. And instead you get this kind of retread idea that develops the characters a little bit, but doesn't really develop the story. But then you also do get like one of the great... The season was full of these intense... really suspenseful scenes. It's funny that he does that the best, and it's like, it's almost like he's not interested in it as much, but when he wants to do it, he can really, really do it.
Right.
And that scene of Angela infiltrating the FBI building and that
so tense.
Yeah, so
fucking
good.
Tense. I think by the way, there's a... so I actually don't follow or listen to anything Esmail says. But I read Reddit, and I think that there is a difference there. Like, to me, it clearly... To me, art is ruined when I hear the creators talk too much about it. Because there's no guarantee that they have any skill in talking about their own art anyway.
It's funny, because I get that, although I will say that listening to a podcast that Esmail was on after the season made me feel better about the season.
Yeah.
Like, maybe. And it's just because of how guileless he is. Like, he really, because he follows all the stuff. Like, he reads every review. He talks about it. Like, he's really interested in knowing what people liked and what they didn't. And, you know, not that it compromises his vision, but that's so different than, like, the Matt Weiners of the world or even the David Simons.
That
he's just so out there and open to it. There was something very... And also just, like, talking about other shows. Like, he loves the Louis show, Horace and Pete. And he was talking about seeing Sully. And, like, I don't know. There was something very sort of... It warmed me to what was a season that was... We're going to get to some of the major plot points. But I think the major frustration was that it was a cocktease season. It was like...
Somebody described it as the equivalent of edging. Like, you're just, like, constantly bringing you to the point of orgasm and just letting go.
And there's a question as whether you feel that at the end of the season, too. Because then it's, like, it's one thing to feel it for a week. It's another thing to feel it for a year.
Well, so the other thing I have to say is that I think that the complexity of the plot increased substantially. And that it actually it's challenging to follow. And as you were saying that Esmail is, like, very involved in sort of the online discussion about his own show, it's very clear that he is paying attention to, like, Redditors and the hacking community. He's very literally taking the Elliot's treatment of the audience as sort of the way that he is treating the audience,
right?
Like a character that is involved in the show.
Yep.
And you really see that just the amount of effort that his team puts into the hacking stuff and the Easter eggs, which can get to the point where, well, if you really need to know any of this stuff in order to understand the story, then maybe it's asking a bit too much of the watcher, but it's fun. I've really enjoyed that part.
So I agree that it can be fun. I'm wondering if it's necessary, because those two things are different. So you know, the Easter eggs, the email addresses on the FBI board that we see at the end and what they lead to, they seem funny and, you know, like, it's impressive that he puts that much into the meta aspects of the show. But are they, but I guess you're going to try to say that they're necessary to the plot.
I think that you're exactly right in pointing out that that question has no good answer. Like, if what I, if like some of the things that I'm going to say are true, then that means that we need to take seriously some of the Easter eggs. But if I have to take seriously some of the, like, the Easter eggs, how the hell do I know which ones
to take
are relevant to the plot and which ones are just a sideshow?
And then is that fair to the people?
Is that fair to the viewer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, is that asking too much? I mean, this is a show that doesn't, that asked way more of its audience than it did in the first season. Just like, trust me, like, whatever with the longer episodes, like, I don't care how long an episode is.
I didn't even notice.
But all right, let's talk about, like, so then you've, all of a sudden there's this phase two that everybody's talking about, and
that's like the mid-season little bump to say, like, there's, this isn't a dead season, there is a plot, and it turns out there was a second phase.
Yes, and we don't know what the second phase is. We find out in the last episode, or at least we think we do. Meanwhile, there's still no, there's nothing about Tyrell that we know for sure yet. He's been sending Joanna Willick gifts. Or at least,
right, or
think
like somebody's
he has.
Been sending.
Somebody's been sending her. Maybe it's Elliot. Maybe it's. There was a huge theory about whether Tyrell is Elliot. They call it the
third
Tyrell-iot
personality. Yeah.
Theory. Right. And, you know, that in the first season, I was very much on board with the idea that Joanna and Tyrell were projections of his parents. And that Elliot was like that little baby that was born. And that became, not because of me, but that was a kind of a leading theory that Tyrell was coming back in time to, you know, that somehow that baby was Elliot. And so that was like...
I can hear Paul Bloom's eyes rolling at us.
I know. I know the sound of two eyes rolling, but what is the sound of one eye rolling? That became a leading theory that Elliot's, it's not whether Tyrell is alive or dead, but what, is he even real? And, you know, there's a lot of questions about that, and a lot of things that happen on the show that make you kind of question that.
Right. So I mean, this season, even if you believe that Tyrell was real, this season I think there was heavy hinting that he was real, but he got killed.
Yeah.
And that now he had become an integrated sort of third personality due to some break or guilt that Elliot felt.
Meanwhile, White Rose, I mean, there was the whole, you know, the FBI operation is called Operation Berenstain. We talked about this in our bonus episode, but, like, you know, there's a lot of alternate reality talk. White Rose actually says, sometimes I think of realities where the hack didn't happen. Would you want that reality? And so they are feeding the conspiracy theorists
and Angela's interrogation.
There was a split between people who wanted it to be like that and people who didn't. And a lot of the critics also, I think most of the critics didn't want it to be anything fucked up. They were like Paul Bloom, right? They wanted it to be just way more straightforward, and they would have been disappointed. I think people have been traumatized by Lost, how that didn't pay off.
It's funny to say. I was a lot of what I'm going to say is influenced by both our discussions Reddit, but also a conversation I had with Yoel about this last night, and we were both talking about this very thing. There's like it's a funny thing to say, but it's like there's a post Lost world in which there is. That is the worst accusation you could make of somebody.
Right.
Right? Like, oh, shit, you didn't even know where you were taking this, and now, you know. The same thing happened, by the way, the David Lynch TV series.
Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks. It's funny, but, like, that was pre-internet, so, like, people just kind of let it go, and now it's remembered as just being really cool. And
right.
Whereas Lost is remembered as, I don't know,
like, meaningless meanderings through potential things that just turned out to no payoff.
Okay, let's get to the big question. So
yeah.
Darlene gets captured by the FBI because they take in one of the F Society people to the hospital, and Dom finds out that her and Cisco are out there, and Dark Army people try to kill both Cisco and Darlene. Darlene survives. Cisco's brain gets splattered all over.
In an amazing scene, by the way. God. But there's an important.
It's worth it just for that scene.
Just that scene is so fucking amazing. The way that the tension is built, the counting down of the street.
Interspersed with Angela and Elliot on the subway. Yeah. That's just like redeems anything.
So
like,
good.
Like everybody who doesn't like this season should shut the fuck up just because of that.
Just enjoy. This is my number one sort of take home to me, is that I'm enjoying the ride. In the post-Lost world, I will less allow the outcome to influence my enjoyment of the show.
Yeah.
Because it might be a dud of an outcome, but I'm enjoying the ride.
But no matter what, there was so much, just the scenes, just the composition of the shots is enough to make it completely worthwhile. The music, the fucking music, holy shit.
The music is amazing. And Angela singing karaoke in like a very normal karaoke voice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, no. But so there's a critical plot point, though, that that I think is critical, at least, is that the Femto Cell, it turns out that the Dark Army had essentially taken control of the Femto Cell that was used to surveil the FBI's communications. And the F Society didn't know this. When they found it out, they tried to set up a meeting and confront the Dark Army to see what the hell was going on. And they were like, it's part of phase two. And they're like, what the fuck is phase two? And they're like, you find out from the Dark Army's communication,
right,
White Rose, that Elliot actually was behind phase two. So how, like, she was confused as to why F Society wouldn't already know this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So then we get to the finale, which I think everybody says should have just been 1 week. But they are very different episodes. They're both called Python, but the first one starts with Elliot going into a dreamlike state, lucid dreaming, where he's going to try to figure out what's going on by being the observer of Mr. Robot. Up till now, it's always Mr. Robot that gets to watch him do things, but now he's going to be doing...
And really, really sort of a... Maybe brilliant, maybe frustrating, doubling down on the unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
In a crazy way. You're like, okay, I guess there's an out here for everything, in that, like, we were explicitly told that this is a dream. You know?
Right.
So should I trust anything that's happening? On the other hand, you could just say, no, that's what it requires for him to observe the real interactions.
Meanwhile, Angela, who has been captured at the end of last episode by, we think, our FBI agents, is being taken to New Jersey.
The ultimate punishment.
Yeah. She goes into a house where there's all these pictures but duct tape over the pictures' faces, like the people in the pictures' faces.
Yeah.
And then she goes into this room, and it's like she's back in time with, you know, the
Commodore 64.
Commodore 64. And a little girl walks out that looks like a little mini Angela, dressed in a suit. And
a little power suit.
And says, and there's this big fish. And, you know, Angela was the one that was taking care of QWERTY, the fish that Elliot had. And they say, the little girl says, we have to do this test. The fish is going to die if we don't do the test. And then her first question is, have you ever cried during sex?
Right.
From this little, like, 8-year-old or 9-year-old or whatever she is.
It is jarring, right? It's super jarring that that's the first question to come out of her mouth. And her insistence, like, through Angela's complete, like, what the fuck? Like, no, answer this. Like,
have you ever cried during sex? And Andrew's like, at first, it has a normal reaction, which is, I'm not answering that question. Like, and then the girl says, they'll beat me if you don't do this test. And she shows these, like, whip marks on her back.
Right. Right.
And so, Andrew,
by the way, the answer, I mean, it should be, do you ever not cry during sex? Because right, most people do, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just wanted to make sure.
During, after, before. Yeah, so okay, so far, like, questions. On the last several episodes, you've said to the women that you cry during sex and that you videotape it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, what am I going to do, lie? So this was really reminiscent of the Harrison Ford tests to prove if someone's a replicant or not. What's it, in Blade Runner, yeah. This is like a David Lynch-directed Blade Runner scene.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was David Lynch directs Blade Runner. It looked like a Mulholland Drive, Twin Peaks kind of scene, and it was, but it was doing the same thing of like testing to see if somebody's real. And the test only gets stranger. There's like a call from a computerized voice that asks you, like, you're in a room, like, how do you get out? And then there's this focus on a key.
Mm-hmm.
And what's her question, the little girl's question?
Is the key in the room.
She's like, the key to what? And she's like, is the key in the room? And then Angela looks at on the table, and there's an old copy of Lolita.
Right.
One of her questions relevantly at this point was, have you ever fantasized about killing your father?
Right.
And I think Angela says no. And from all we've seen, like, they have a good relationship. It's a little, they seem to have a decent relationship, her and her father. So that's a weird question, too. But then they ask about the key. Is the key in the room? You see that there's a paperback copy of Lolita. And then Angela answers, the key was in my fist. My fist was in my pocket. Which is, and I think this is the thing, like, all the people who want to have a straightforward reading of the series, like, they can't explain this. That is a line from Lolita that Humbert says right when he's in the hotel where he first has sex with Lolita, and he's wandering around the hotel. He ends up meeting Quilty, the sort of antagonist who you don't know if he's real or not. He's thinking, as he's talking to him, I had the key. The key was in my fist. My fist was in my pocket. He's drugged Lolita, and he's going to go back up there and have sex with her. That's what he thinks at the time. That's not how it goes down, but that's what he thinks at the time. What the fuck? Why is she saying that? And every explanation where this was just a test of Angela for White Rose doesn't explain her responding to that question, is the key in the room, and her responding that way. I'm sorry. Like, there's just no...
I have an answer.
Okay.
But it's it'll delve into some nerdery.
That's fine.
And this is actually the bulk of the conversation I was having with you all last night. So let's just say that we've outlined the plot. There's a last scene where throughout the second half of the season, we don't know what's happened to Mobley and Trenton, right?
Yeah.
And we see them outside of a Fry's, which is an electronics store in Arizona. And they're talking about, basically, they realize that the hack has fucked things over, and they want to undo it. So they're having a discussion about how to undo this, which is, again, a sort of a tease about time travel to me, but also at the level of reality, what they're talking about, just by the way, when Leon shows up, and that's what we're left with. We don't know what's going to happen to them. The hack was taking all of E-Corp's data and encrypting it. And the way in which you encrypt it is this super strong encryption, the 256-bit AES encryption that everybody sort of understands is essentially unbreakable. It would require like thousands of years of computers churning out at their best effort, right? Which is one reason I think you all pointed this out, that White Rose's obsession with time. That all of the data that E-Corp has that they have on E-Corp is encrypted, and that's why it's inaccessible to E-Corp.
But it's not deleted.
They didn't delete it. And in fact, it would take a lot longer to delete all of that than it would just to put an unbreakable layer of encryption on it. And this is where we see what phase two is supposed to be. Basically, there are paper records that could be used to rebuild all of the banking data that E-Corp had, because it appears as if E-Corp wants to take advantage of this situation and construct its own banking system using their version of Bitcoin, which they call E-Coin. And I think the tension between White Rose and the Dark Army and E-Corp is who's going to take control of the new currency, the new world economy, where the Dark Army wants to introduce their own sort of Bitcoin. There are conversations earlier on about China's use of Bitcoin.
Evil Corp wants to do E-Coin.
Evil Corp wants to do E-Coin, where they would essentially have complete control over currency. So the keys for encryption have to be generated. And one of the ways in which they have to be generated is through using random numbers in order to ensure that the numbers that are generated, these prime numbers that are generated to make these keys, are unbreakable. So if they're not random, then you can just reverse engineer the process that made them. And so usually the encryption programs have to find a source of true randomness in nature. So they'll often use the random mouse movements of the user or the thermal readout from what's going on inside of the computer. They're just seeking true randomness. I think that what's happened is that all of a sudden White Rose realizes, because remember White Rose was right, why are you still here, Angela? What the fuck are you doing?
She should have been dead.
She should have been dead. Why does she keep popping up? What is her importance? What's her role in this story? I think that Elliot, who was the hacker that encrypted all of this, somehow used Angela, some part of Angela, as the key.
The encryption key.
The encryption key. There is something in Angela.
Whoa.
Right? Maybe her body, her fingerprints, something that is the key. I think that is the realization that White Rose has during that interrogation. Maybe she even reveals this to Angela, which gets Angela to realize that,
White Rose reveals that to Angela.
Yeah. We don't know, because we don't know whether she actually flipped her or whether she was brainwashing.
So one thing
her.
We haven't said is that the Washington Township plant,
yes,
is a big topic in this season, which is the plant that ended up giving Angela and Elliot's parents leukemia and killing them, and sort of what motivated them. White Rose wants her hands on that plant, and Angela's trying to bring it down from within E-Corp, and White Rose wants her to stop, and right. and wants, you know, she gets into a big fight with Philip Price in a scene in the cemetery after White Rose pees on the grave of the previous which is great, with what right. we have to assume was a vagina.
Is that the technical term?
So White Rose says to her, your parents died for a reason. If I tell you the reason, will you get on board with us?
Right. Right. And we don't.
So how does that fit into
we're never told what the reason is.
Yeah.
So here is the possibility. White Rose is selling Angela the idea of the possibility of using Bitcoin, which is the sort of great equalizer, right? The reason Bitcoin is popular is because it completely circumvents governments and banks. Now, why does White Rose and China, why are they so interested in the power plant? Well, it requires, and this part I think got what somebody pointed out on Reddit, to make Bitcoin the e-currency, you need to introduce scarcity. And the way that scarcity is introduced is that it becomes increasingly hard to what they call mine Bitcoin. So the first few Bitcoins that were ever made were essentially you're giving...
What is Bitcoin? I don't even know.
Yeah, Bitcoin is an electronic version of currency that is that can be used, for instance, and this is through in Silk Road, right? That's how you would pay. So Bitcoin is essentially encrypted math, encrypted numbers that are serving as currency.
But how? Like when you say the first few Bitcoins that were made were
honestly, there are limits to my knowledge and the limits to the patience of any listener. But the whole point of Bitcoin is the brilliance of it is that that you could have an e-currency that just meant, okay, electronically, you get a dollar, I get a dollar. But there was no easy way to actually prevent inflation from being rampant, like unless it's backed by some government or some, you know, like gold backs or silver backs or something. And the reason that Bitcoin is this huge advancement is that it is a mathematical solution to this problem. It essentially requires you to, every time you generate a new Bitcoin, to solve a harder and harder and harder math problem. So that nowadays, if you want to create a new Bitcoin, if you want to mine one and generate like one new Bitcoin, it takes the computational power of like a bunch of computers.
So if I wanted to buy something on Silk Road, how do I get?
So you need a Bitcoin wallet, and it is a little program that is allowing you people to exchange what right now are fractions of Bitcoin. And it's completely a local encryption. If you lose, for instance, like if you had the little Bitcoin wallet on a hard drive and you lost that hard drive, you lost all the money. So it's not, it doesn't exist on a network.
But how do I get it in the first place? Like, do I need to pay money for it? Online gambling sites where I could get on it for fewer fees if I used Bitcoin, but I have no idea how to do that.
Yeah, you would download a little program and you would somehow do a transaction so that you could acquire Bitcoin. I haven't done it. I think at some point I might have downloaded one of these little programs, but had no use for it. So somebody pointed out that in order to manufacture Bitcoin, you're needing increasing amounts of power. And China is essentially on a grab for power plants in the U.S. to churn out the power that's necessary to churn out Bitcoin.
Uh-huh.
And so that might be one. We're given a kind of an explanation that the phase two hack, where all of the paper records that are being brought to this one building and they're going to be scanned in independent of, like, off the grid for E-Corp to recreate all of the financial documents and therefore regain control of the economy. That's what the Dark Army is trying to thwart. And the way that they seem to be thwarting this is by creating brownouts so that building, if it wants reliable power to like scan in the documents, will need to use a set of batteries, the uninterruptible power supplies, which is essentially just a gajillion batteries in that building to make sure the operation works throughout the brownouts.
Yeah.
And because of that,
they can exploit it.
Yeah, they can exploit the UPSs.
So wow. So first of all, nice job with that. You also don't think Elliot's real. Does that connect to this?
Tyrell, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that Tyrell is real. I think that everything is explainable with a fake Tyrell. And I think that it's odd that he's been missing. I think it's odd that he's in this like perfectly sharp suit. I think it's odd that he professes his love for Elliot. I don't know. But that's not
connected to this theory.
Right. At least I haven't connected it. There's one.
What about Angela saying the key was in my pocket about the Lolita thing? So how does that, like you said, oh, my theory will explain that. But why would she be quoting something from Lolita?
I don't know how Lolita is in there, in the room, right?
Yeah.
And so, so maybe there is a point of realization where Angela may have realized that she she was a key.
Like, and she had memorized a line from Lolita?
No, I mean, I think that the reason that she said it was she's being asked about the key, and Lolita, the book, is right there. And so she's read it somewhat recently.
And
which I, well, way over my head, actually, because I never read Lolita. I have no idea.
That line struck a chord. I've read it a couple of times. I think it's a total masterpiece. I mean, more than, I guess, probably two or three times at least. And I just think that that's, you know, and all, and the questions about have you ever cried during sex, and the question about fantasizing about killing your father, and then Lolita's there, and then she's, and all of this, if you take it on the surface, and it even in, it seems like this is covered by your theory, is a kind, all of this weirdness and killing the big fish that's in the fish tank, and the little girl that's apparently trained by the Dark Army to do a weird test of people. Like, all of that is just to test Angela to see if she's, like, what?
No, I mean, I genuinely think that White Rose was trying to figure out what role Angela was playing. And I
but
think
why
that
was
this,
that the method to try to figure
oh,
that out?
I mean, I think that she's trying to no, I don't. I think that that test was some sort of pseudoscientific, like, figuring out her vulnerabilities in order to, like, fuck with her and manipulate her. Like, I think that's all that was. I think that at some point she realizes that it was that she, why she matters. But I think that was just like a, you know, like pseudo-psychological way to, it's basically a personality test, right? So we have these, like, you know, there are tests that ask weird questions, like the, to figure out if you're schizophrenic or whatever, like, and they ask weird questions like that. I think that's all that was. Have you ever taken a Scientology personality test, by the way, where they have you, like, hold on to the electrodes and they ask you questions?
I was really drunk when I took one. But, no, really, like, my friends and I got really drunk. Like, otherwise, why would you go in there?
They're like, we've determined through our science that you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, they did, right? No, in fact, they scolded us for doing that. But, I mean, okay. But anyway, so I really hope that's not true, because I just don't buy that. Like, think about what you're really saying. Like, this was their plan. We're going to go.
Why would I?
We're
going to
capture Angela on the subway, and we're going to set up this house. We're going to put duct tape all over the photos in this New Jersey house that we now own. Oh, and we have this little girl, this little white,
but that's just
blonde American girl that we keep around in case something like this happens. And we're going to paint or tattoo some whip marks on her back. And then we're going to give her this script. But and then we're also going to, like, have a computerized voice call her. And we're going to make it seem like it's 1995 with a Commodore 64. Feel vulnerable so that she'll be willing to, like, that just doesn't, like, I, like.
No. Hold on. You're pointing to the absurdity of everything. But whether my explanation, no explanation can account for that absurdity. Like, what explanation would make that actually make any sense whatsoever? Like, the best explanation, I think, is that they are just doing whatever they can to totally fuck with her.
Right. That's, I guess, I don't find that a satisfying explanation, because that is the that's the leading explanation, you know, once White Rose appears. And it's cool that you don't know, like, what the hell is going on, and then all of a sudden White Rose is there, and she's giving her 28 minutes, which for White Rose is like, that's like saying,
eternal.
That's like with, like, a student comes in, and I'll say, yeah, I'll talk about your first draft with you for 10 hours or something like that. What the hell? And so I guess that's the explanation. They did this to fuck with her. I just don't buy that that's how you fuck with somebody. That they even, to get a little blonde girl who looks like her to dress
how
her up.
How is that the most mysterious thing? That is, like, trivially easy. Like, presumably they have operatives, like, throughout, and they just, to borrow somebody's kid to, like, have them, like, put on a suit and ask those questions is not.
And but why, like, I guess, like, if that's really what it was, I don't know why.
I mean,
that,
like, they could have tortured
me,
her.
Like, that, but, especially but I, given that they've been teasing us with these alternate timelines, these alternate realities, Back to the Future music throughout that whole first episode, right? I mean, that whole first episode of the finale.
So look, this is now at my like dubiousest.
Yeah.
This is my most insane crazy theory. That and this again requires a certain level of nerdery.
I can't wait to hear this.
Okay. So I was explaining that you need the program that's generating the key gets a source of randomness. And that source of true randomness, like a real random thing, can come from a variety of sources. Sometimes they use it, right? Like I was saying, they use the thermal input readout from the temperatures that are fluctuating in the computer. Sometimes just the random movements that people make, micro movements with their mouse. But somehow you need a true random number generator to make these keys unbreakable, or at least unbreakable by anything we have that wouldn't take thousands and thousands of years. So one possibility is that I can't even believe that I'm going to say this.
I really, because I've always been the weird,
yeah,
fucking,
I know. Okay, so
psycho stoner.
So one, nothing. No, suppose that Dark Army wants to decrypt the data. They want to take control of all the data that's been encrypted by these keys.
Yeah.
You would have to dedicate thousands of hours of computation to do this. And the true randomness of the events that generated the key are really the barrier. So they're running simulations of the event that Elliot used to generate the keys. And they're crunching a bunch of simulations to try to replicate whatever he did in order to generate those keys.
And whatever he did involved Angela, right?
And maybe involved Angela, maybe some biological feature of Angela, like something in Angela. And that's what all those computers are being used for, to try their hardest to run simulations of reality to replicate the initial circumstances that gave rise to that random generation of the keys, because that is in some way more efficient than actually trying to crack the code. So, okay, that's the...
What is that? Like, I don't... So, that doesn't
so they
sound...
Are, I don't know
you
how...
built it up to be crazy.
The craziness is that they are actually creating entire simulated worlds and running each scenario to see if that is the simulated world that
gave rise to the... So, we might be seeing some of those simulated worlds.
Yep. And there might be some crazy bleed over from one simulation to another.
I see. That is fucked up. Yeah.
And Elliot might be the number one victim of these simulations. Like, there is something about the flickering of Mr. Robot at the end that is what you would expect if he was in a really complicated video game.
Right.
Right?
So Elliot... they're doing this simulation because of something that Elliot had done, right?
Yes.
So you have a real world,
yeah.
And then you have, up till the hack, and then you have a bunch of simulations?
No.
But Mr. Robot is pre-hack.
And so there is a literal and metaphorical way in which my explanation is still half-baked. So I don't know. I literally, in my conversation with Yoel last night, was coming up with this, and I don't know exactly how it would explain the pre-hacking. It could be that there was some point at which in those 3 days that are missing, the real shit went down. It could be that Elliot's memories are fucked up because
of his disorder.
Yeah. Or because whatever went down in those 3 days I don't know. It's really tough when you have such an unreliable narrator to know what's going on. But I will say that...
And that could be the Lolita connection. I mean, this is one of the issues with the show is he's such a fan of movies and literature and he's a fan of the same things that I am, too, which is what makes it Kubrick, David Lynch, Tarantino, Nabokov, these are the things that I love, too. So that's what makes the show.
He's a blend of yours and my interests.
But one answer to my Lolita question is He loves Lolita. He knows that line. He thought it would be cool to like have her speak a line from Lolita,
right.
You know? And
right.
And that's always the reason why that looks like American Psycho is because he loves American Psycho. The reason why that whole episode seems like Mulholland Drive is because that's one of his favorite movies of all time.
Right.
So that's this other thing that sort of stands in the way of really trying to read into too much. But
and
I really like your idea, actually, I have to say.
Thanks.
Like, this is actually very cool.
This actually helps the first part of the season have a real payoff because Craig Robinson, the warden's real problem was in his implementation of Bitcoin. That is, Elliot hacking around with the Bitcoin problem could have a real payoff. In that we learn something about how Bitcoin works and what Elliot knows about Bitcoin, which is central to the Dark Army's goals now.
Yeah, I mean, like, if it has a payoff, then that payoff. This is one of the issues with doing the show.
You, I know.
And Sam Esmail talks about this. It's like he's like people are sort of carping or complaining, but I think of this as this one big story that I'm telling. And, you know, people don't go, you know, in a movie, people don't say, wait, I don't understand why Jules is acting like this in Pulp Fiction.
Right.
He didn't say that, but that was sort of the implication of like, you have to evaluate the whole thing. But
it's just hard when you have to wait another fucking year, you know, and it's like,
yeah.
Wait, this huge payoff in like 3 years or like what, you know.
And, you know, like this year, you've been very patient with it. And then you hear about this phase two, and you're waiting to also figure out what the fuck is going on with Tyrell, who you got kind of attached to as a character in the first season. And then you find out that phase two is blowing up a building with a bunch of paper in it.
It was disappointing.
And
that's like
that
really?
We're not even going to do it.
Yeah.
And so then you wonder, like, okay, fine. Like, it is trying to tell a long story, but I don't know, like Breaking Bad had a theme every year. The Wire, even though it's part of a larger picture, has a story that it's telling every single year. And those stories fit into the larger story. The first season of Mr. Robot had a story it was telling there that was part of a larger picture. I don't know if season two had that.
So this is a good analogy with The Wire. Season two of The Wire, where they move from the streets, like inner city, to the docks.
Yeah.
They tell a completely different story in a way that I actually was disappointed. I did not like that season the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
It becomes a great show because
Absolutely.
Of that move, because of the move to the docks, and then the greater picture starts emerging, that this wasn't just a street-level cops and robbers tale,
yeah.
Police procedural. So, no.
Okay, so I thought of that too, which is why like season two of The Wire may not be the best example of what I'm talking about, because people were dissatisfied. I had to grow to love that season as much as I love all the other seasons. It's not like I didn't like it.
Right.
I maintain, however, that it had an arc. Like,
internally,
it had an arc that was resolved at the end of the season. And the thing that people didn't like about it was, wait, we love Avon, we love Weebay, we love Stringer,
yeah.
we love
yeah.
D. And
now we got to go to these.
And now it's all
freaks.
these new people that we have to figure out. But at least, like, you had an arc of that story. And you get a little bit of that with Dom, I guess, and the arc of learning that the FBI knew a fuckload more than we would have thought that they knew about F Society.
Right.
And
so how many seasons are planned out for Mr. Robot? Does he have a...
So I don't know.
So, but we do know that he at least has claimed that he has a story arc.
Yeah. And I think... Like, I've heard talk of 4 or 5 seasons. I think he's said that it definitely won't be more than 5 seasons. But I guess my worry is, like, I would much rather it be told in the number of seasons necessary to tell the story well.
Yeah.
Even if that means that we get one fewer season.
Well, and so that
and
might, yeah.
And I just wonder if maybe that was an issue with this season, that it was stretching out what maybe was part of one season.
Right, that's
into
one possibility.
A whole season.
Although I will say this, after having said that I don't follow Sam Esmail off like when he talks about the show, there was an interview, and maybe you heard it. All I saw was the Reddit headline where he says that there is one thing that he feels like he's been telegraphing.
Yes,
and you know, maybe we're just missing.
I thought it was the stuff with the father-daughter stuff. Because it is weird how that's not a topic that people are talking about very much. The fact that clearly like the disconnect between that whole thing and the crying during sex and the father fantasizing about killing her father. Like, where did that come from? And Lolita, given that we see Angela seeming very close to her father and like a really nice kind of relationship in a right. in a show that doesn't have very many nice
father
relationships. Yeah, father-child relationships or even just relationships, period.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so frustrating for him to say that there's one big obvious
thing.
I'm like,
that's
no, there
great.
Isn't. Like, clearly there isn't.
I don't know, but here's the thing. Like you said, well, maybe like in that first episode, I feel like all of season two was, okay, but then in the next episode, we're going to find out something, and we never did. It was like,
it's like a Zeno. I felt like it was Zeno's paradox of TV telling, right? Storytelling, where like I always felt right. like I was halfway there.
But it's still cool. Like, I don't want to trash it at all because I really liked the season.
You reminded me of something that I did want to say. Okay, so my suspicion that there's still no evidence that Tyrell is real, comes from a couple of things. One more genuine than the other. One is that we've seen that Mr. Robot can harm himself, that Elliot can harm himself, right? We saw that with his father pushing him off the pier.
Right.
And that becomes, I think, potentially a critical plot point where we know like it could very well be that he took the gun to himself.
Because it does seem like he would have had to shoot himself in the gut for Tyrell not to be real. Because that's a real bullet, it seems.
Yeah.
Like. Or else like
what
you know
yeah, what
fuck the show if like we can't trust
Yeah, I know. Yeah. What doesn't jibe with this is that it seems as if Angela's talking to Tyrell in a way that it's unclear
Who would be waking up?
Who would be talking to Angela and who would be waking up? I mean, it could be that he shot himself in some sort of non-lethal way and sort of the other personality took over. But
what makes you think that he's dead? So this was my final little bit of criticism was like the whole ride that we were supposed to go on of thinking he wasn't real. And then it being shocking that he was real when he shot him. I mean, I think that's how people interpreted it for the most part is, oh, like, they played with you to make you doubt the reality of Tyrell, and then you end the season knowing for sure that Tyrell is
real.
Everybody
thinks it's for sure, and I don't know why I haven't caught that.
I agree with you that I think there's no reason to be sure, but why... You seem to think there's still good reason to think he's not real. And I guess that's what I don't get. I mean, I know Mr. Robot said that he shot him. He didn't even say that he killed him, actually. He just said that he shot him.
Right. And he was alive in the trunk. It's not good reason, but it is reason to doubt that he's actually alive. What I'm saying is that I'm suspicious of the firm conclusion that he's alive. The things that led us to think that he might be alive, the phone calls and the gifts were shown to be just like the fuckery of what's his name to Jordan
Scott Knowles.
Like,
Scott Knowles like was sending her the gifts and tried to kill her and Joanna Wellick like definitely like in some ways the best character of the show is gonna try to frame him and we haven't even gotten to
and
that.
It's unclear to me what role Joanna is really playing in this if he's been dead the whole time. But one reason we were given to think that he might still be alive was that, and that was shown to be not him at all. Then there's the possibility that we've already seen that Mr. Robot can cause serious damage to Elliot. So Elliot can definitely harm himself. And then there is what is a kooky, like I think it was posted on Reddit as a joke. But it actually is the kind of thing that Sam Esmail might really have done on purpose. So and I think I told you this, that even though this has happened before, it seemed odd to me that Tyrell was so quiet during the whole argument where Mr. Robot is yelling to Elliot and they're having this fight. Tyrell is just like calmly typing. So I know it can happen. We've seen that happen, but it left me a little suspicious. But then the if you look at what Tyrell is running on the computer, he's running GNOME desktop environment. It's a particular layer of Linux that harkens back to that first time that Elliot and Tyrell meet. And Tyrell says, "I see you're running GNOME." And he says, "Me, I'm a KDE man myself." So those are two different desktop environments in Linux. And if it were Tyrell, he ought to be running KDE. He said that he runs KDE, but no, that computer has GNOME.
Except that he now worships Elliot.
Yeah, so maybe.
That's a sign of how much he worships Elliot, that he's willing to run GNOME.
For some Linux people, that would be akin to you changing to become a Yankees fan because you really liked somebody. But yeah, that's I'll end this the weed smoking. Well,
so every once in a while throughout the history of this podcast, and we're going to have our 100th episode soon, you come out with something like your Unforgiven God analogy. You just come like with your A game, like you're capable of these flights of genius to the point where it does make me question, like, who's the other David Lazaro? The one that, you know, like, just says whatever, like, liberal Facebook wants him to say. And,
yeah, this the
social
justice
two different
warrior.
People? Because this is a real...
Is that why I don't remember these episodes?
Yes, exactly.
Mind awake? No, mind asleep, body asleep is my mantra.
There's a Mr. P.
Another way of saying what you're saying is that I am mediocre through large, vast portions of my life.
You reach heights that I can't imagine. Like, I needed to not... I've been looking all around me. I needed to look above me. I love him.
Nice. We gotta end there. That's nice. Yeah. Perfect. I love it.
All right. Join us next time for our 100th episode. Very Bad With It.
Very bad wizard.